What I'm really trying to say there is people perceived vaccines were being forced on them. That is not true. When we're forcing something, we literally are strapping somebody down to a gurney and vaccinating them. That used to be done in the United States 100 years ago. It is not the case now.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is Justice by Design, a podcast that talks to the people who are finding solutions to real problems that we all face in our society. You know, I talked a little bit on social media and probably on this pod and my other podcast, hashtag sisters-in-law, about having the flu this season. And I have to say, I think that was the sickest I've ever been from a viral infection, and that's including the first time I had COVID. I had a flu shot, but it still really knocked me out to the point that it took weeks for me to fully recover. My mom, who's in her 80s, also had it and had a terrible time. And I was grateful that at least we had some protection, which likely kept us both out of the hospital. So that's why I was so alarmed to learn just this week that the Center for Disease Control has canceled a meeting, their annual meeting, where they discuss which strains of the flu should be targeted for next year's flu shot. No reason was given for canceling that meeting, according to a report by NBC. But just having just suffered from this, feared for my mom's life when she suffered from it, and knowing people who have died from this year's flu, just underscored how much vaccination policy is important to us all. And I want to talk about that in this episode. And I'm so grateful to be joined by James Hodge. James Hodge is a professor at Arizona State University's Sandra Day O'Connor School of Law. James, thanks for joining me.
Well, it's a real pleasure, Kim. Thanks for having me.
So before we get started and talking about vaccine policy, just introduce yourself a little to our listeners. Tell us what you do there at Arizona State and where you get your vaccine policy expertise from.
Thank you so much. Well, here at Arizona State at our College of Law, I direct what's known as our Center for Public Health Law and Policy. I've been doing so for the last 15 years after time and career back east at Johns Hopkins and at Georgetown. Our center handles everything in the public health legal arena, but let me assure you, vaccination law and policy is always at the forefront of that, and especially against the backdrop of what we're seeing in regards to the current president administration, some of the very substantial changes you're seeing through HHS, CDC, FDA, and other places. So we've been at the forefront of those sorts of issues for many, many years. We've seen it all, but we're seeing things now we've never seen before.
Yeah. So let's start the conversation by going back in history a little bit and talking about vaccine policies that we may know because we know them from our relatives or maybe a generation or two back, but things like polio, which was a massive threat at one point, all by the time I was a kid, it seemed to have all but disappeared. Getting measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines were just something that, where I grew up, was required just to enroll in school. And I don't think I ever knew anybody who had the measles as a kid. So take us from where vaccine policy used to be before we get into what's happening today.
Glad to. We have experienced so many changes in such a rapid period of time. People don't remember, even just a generation ago, what had been in place for dozens of years, and that is very solid adherence by most all Americans to vaccination-related recommendations that came through federal and state and local governments. They applied to schools, they applied to daycare settings, they applied to healthcare worker settings, and all of these, Kim, were built around laws designed to assure great access to vaccines that had been proven efficacious, proven to work, in other words, in regards to tamping down conditions like polio, smallpox, other scourges like what you're seeing with, of course, measles now, all vaccine-preventable conditions. Fortunately, smallpox has now been eradicated globally. The reality is, for all of us, vaccine laws and policies were proven over 100-plus years to flat-out work, to raise vaccination rates. We adhered to those. Americans fell in line with those specific recommendations. that's all changed in the last 15 to 20 years and changed extensively.
Yeah. And so what has been some of the drivers of that change? Because it's not all about policy, right? There have been folks who have been vaccine hesitant. There have been theories and, dare I say, conspiracy theories about the safety of vaccines that has caused real concern. I'm not suggesting that every single person who has fear about vaccines is a conspiracy theorist. I submit that a lot of people have been misled and misinformed. But sort of talk about the movement. I remember when I first started working at the Boston Globe 20 some odd years ago as an intern covering health and science, I covered, among other things, an anti-vaccine conference at a time where there was a claim that thimerosal, an ingredient in vaccines, was linked to autism, something that has been disproven. Talk a little bit about the anti-vaccine movement throughout our history.
Yeah, you bet. Listen, that's not, although the phenomenon around it, what Americans are seeing and experiencing and being influenced by as we speak, you know, seems all new and current, but the reality is we've had anti-vaccination sentiments in place in the United States for over 100 years. In fact, one of the most famous U.S. Supreme Court cases dealt with an anti-vaccinationist over 115 years ago challenging a smallpox vaccine. That specific challenge was refuted by the Supreme Court, but what the anti-vaccination person at that point in time was suggesting were liberty violations and freedom issues related to having to actually undergo a vaccination, even though it was not compelled. The reality is vaccine laws in the United States are always built around a few exceptions. There are exceptions, for example, nobody can be vaccinated against their will when they are in immunocompromised status. If the vaccine could literally hurt you directly, if that's the case and you can demonstrate it, you're not going to be vaccinated or required to be vaccinated. Second, there are religious exemptions. The U.S. Supreme Court has never fully endorsed a flat-out First Amendment religious exemption to all vaccine policy, but most states have done so. Some states like California and New York dropped those because of high rates of sort of religious uptake on those exemptions. There's even philosophical exemptions in a lot of jurisdictions. I'm right here in Phoenix, Arizona, and in Phoenix, Arizona, getting a vaccine exemption is as easy as walking into your school and simply claiming you just don't want your child to be vaccinated. Check whatever box you need to in regards to that. Why do I bring all that up? Because those are the routes through which anti-vaccination sentiment can then find their way into sort of derating or lowering vaccine rates among school kids and other specific populations. When persons get a sense that a vaccine may pose a risk, that it may have a dangerous element in it, some of the anti-vaccination sentiment even from decades ago was all about introducing foreign substances into the body viewed as religiously opposed in some ways. Very few religions actually directly set as a mantra opposition to vaccine, but those that do will often very effectively announce that. And then, Kim, as you noted, just absolute pure misinformation around the threats and risks of vaccines. At one point, more of a liberal cause, like in more wealthy communities in California, San Francisco, and other places, liberals were the ones who were resisting vaccine, concerned about what impact it could have on their children. Now it's turned into a little more of a conservative cause, as we're seeing with the rise of some of what you're seeing in the second iteration of the Trump administration. The history of it's profound, but misinformation is unquestionably at the grandest source of it right now. People actually believe vaccines are the cause of harm. It's the diseases that cause the harm, not the vaccines, more case than not.
Yeah, so I want to talk now about that intersection between healthcare policy and science, and public health information, and the law, in terms of the mandate versus the claims that such mandates interfere with someone's personal liberty or ability to practice their religion or things like that. And a flashpoint of that was during the COVID pandemic, right? Where we saw a lot of increased mandates in public accommodations and churches and other places being challenged by people who did not want to have to wear a mask or people who did not want to have to be required to get the COVID vaccination in order to access this space. And it sort of became a cultural clash in itself, right?
You bet. Yeah, Kim, so much. All of the cases, hundreds of cases, literally percolating throughout the COVID pandemic on what public health authorities can and cannot do. It's almost difficult even now as we're somewhat removed from the pandemic with it in our rearview mirror. Sadly, though, we still lose hundreds of persons a week to COVID-19 in the United States. But the sheer reality is what we learn from all of those cases can actually be boiled down to a few, I'm not going to say simple observations, but important ones. And they go as follows. First and foremost, vaccines are not compelled. Vaccines are optional for nearly every American, barring, with some exception, prisoners and children that might be under the control of their parents. What I'm really trying to say there is people perceive vaccines were being forced on them. That is not true. When we're forcing something, we literally are strapping somebody down to a gurney and vaccinating them. That used to be done in the United States 100 years ago. It is not the case now. All of these are conditional mandates. If you want to engage in society, go to school, go to university, show up at the theater, travel, you know, nationally or whatever, we might require a vaccine for that purpose, for the protection of everybody around you and yourself. And to that end, even those got challenged significantly. What are some of the really critical takeaways from what we saw from all that jurisprudence during the pandemic? First and foremost, the U.S. Supreme Court, even though it had multiple opportunities, never seriously chastised a vaccine recommendation or mandate. It saw built into those mandates the opportunity for religious exemptions. It saw no vaccine being applied to a person who might be immunocompromised. So the Supreme Court did not actually take that lead, despite several opportunities, and issue, for example, a requirement that the First Amendment must allow for a religious exemption to every vaccine mandate. That was helpful. The second thing is more of these mandates survived than not. What you still see in place across the United States are vaccine mandates for school kids to attend school in most jurisdictions or go to daycare or otherwise. It's not meant as a compelled nature. It is meant as a opportunity, a condition upon receipt of which you get to participate in school or other parts of society. That's still very much at play in the United States, notwithstanding some of the threats we saw and some of the liberty interests that were asserted. Kim, what it really boils down to in my mind is as follows. You know, what Americans maybe have lost sight of is regards to their civic responsibility to each other and to our population overall. We've not lost sight of constitutionally. And that is a nice way of saying, yes, government can still set a vaccine mandate and not infringe your liberty interests. There is no court largely recognized as a significant infringement on your liberty interests pursuant to these vaccine mandates because they're conditional. If you don't want to work or go into that specific setting, you get that choice. But if you're going to do it, if you're going to work in that hospital, you're largely going to get vaccinated before you step into it. That still remains the balance that we've reached constitutionally.
So let's talk about how that constitutional balance is at play here as we are seeing things like you alluded to a measles outbreak currently happening in Texas and New Mexico. Clearly from people who have not gotten vaccinated or have chosen not to vaccinate their children. To me, I am struck that just a couple years out of a pandemic, and as you noted, when it's not COVID is not gone. It's no longer a declared pandemic, but it's not gone. But after having this, new novel virus really take over the world, and we had to do what we could to stop the spread, there is not a sense that, hey, getting this vaccine isn't just about me. It's about the safety of my family, the safety of my community, the safety of our nation. It's still framed in a way as something that is being forced upon people. Is that the difference between now and decades ago, James, where people thought of that more as a public health opportunity as opposed to some sort of infringement on individual rights?
Yeah, Kim, great analysis and great observations, because what you saw during polio, for example, were very long lines, not long lines, objecting to vaccines, long lines to get it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you're starting to see in West Texas too, is people lining up. Please give us access to the measles vaccine. We do understand a little more carefully now, and surely that this risk is too profound. You know, though, the important thing at work here is to understand, just to make sure we're putting this in perspective, yeah. We need 95% sort of vaccine rates to defeat diseases like measles. That's what we would render for measles purposes to be in the realm of what we call herd immunity. We have a sufficient number of Americans, especially kids, who are very good at communicating diseases. They're really good at it because they don't take the sort of hygiene measures that adults might take. When you lack that 95% rate, that's when a disease like measles, which is very, very easily spread, can surface, as it has in West Texas, New Mexico, and I absolutely assure multiple other jurisdictions will see that soon. But let's take stock of one other thing. We still exceed about 90% vaccine rates in a lot of those communities across the United States. We actually generally, as a body politic, as population across the U.S., we do get vaccinated. It's just when you have those specific pockets or regions or particular populations that may be religiously motivated or philosophically motivated that don't seek out vaccines, that's where measles will find it. That's where it can actually kill children, as did happen earlier this week in West Texas. Now, that's where things get difficult. And I'll tell you, it's difficult because that school-aged child had no choice to make in this. His or her parents either got that child vaccinated or didn't. Clearly did not. Measles hit that child. We've lost that life. That is non-defensible. It's what I call a never event in public health. It should not happen. And even against the backdrop of COVID-19 and all of the different vaccine choices that Americans made, COVID-19 was hitting at least an adult population making conscientious choices. If they wanted to risk it, they risked it. And a lot of them, to the tune of 1.2 million, made the wrong choice in that regard. It was, you know, very damaging. But children, that's going to be another calculation with measles that we're going to very carefully assess, I can assure you.
Yeah. So for most of my lifetime, I always thought about vaccine policy as, you know, you get recommendations from federal agency like the CDC, and that trickles down to the state level where they make decisions. Okay, where are we going to have a vaccine requirement for schools or other places? And then you have the local level where you actually go. I remember actually having a physical vaccine card when I was school age. And then when I was accepted into law school, I had to go. And I remember I was living in Michigan and about to go to BU Law. And before I went, I had to find that vaccine record to show that my MMR was up to date. Yeah. Well, now we have a new Secretary of Health and Human Services who is a vaccine skeptic, who has embraced some of these theories that some vaccines are unsafe, or has said other concerning things to me, such as there's a difference in the immune response to Black people than other people, which means that they should have a different vaccine schedule because they are less susceptible to viral disease. Again, as somebody who was laid out with the flu and with COVID, I can assure you anecdotally that is not true. But if people who are vaccine skeptics are at the head of federal vaccine policy, what does that say to you?
Says to me, we've reached a new era. All the anti-vaccination sentiment we've experienced in the last 20 years has been purposeful. It's been on the minority. It's been, you know, on the fringe. And we've been hearing it, and they've had some role to play with it. This is a new game now, Kim. The lead of HHS, in control of hundreds of millions of dollars of vaccine-related dollars and specific committees like at CDC and FDA that set vaccine policy, is himself a unquestioned vaccine skeptic. Some would even call him an anti-vaccinationist, although he made very small or strong claims in the Senate confirmation proceedings that he doesn't go that far. He just questions vaccines. He questions them in a way that he thinks every American quite possibly should question. The sheer reality is, of course, police do question the efficacy of any vaccine, but definitively because of the processes we've created through the FDA, through CDC and other resources, those questions are always happening, always being undertaken and always being considered at the highest scientific levels. When you see a vaccine hit a market, it's undergone all of that specific questioning and risen to the level of being safe and effective for a population of which it's intended. Could be kids, could be elderly adults, could be all of us. When you lead an agency at HHS level and you even plant the idea that these vaccines might not be safe, or you plant the idea that we need more NIH investigations and research into the potential safety harms, or harms that is, of vaccines, you implant within the U.S. population the sheer sense that these vaccines in and of themselves seriously must be questioned. Whether you are an anti-vaccine proponent or not leading into this current administration, I'm very concerned you'll be one coming out of it, because the type of information, misinformation or otherwise, that can come out of those sorts of investigations and that just that assessment can be the type of stuff that can defeat even the very best laid vaccine laws and policies that are, you know, literally around Americans making really good, strong choices about what's in their best interest from a health perspective. We've got still strong vaccine adherence across most of the United States on those particularly childhood vaccinatable conditions. Will that start to succumb to misinformation and lead direction through HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.? That's a huge concern, and we're going to be watching for it extensively.
To what extent do states and municipalities have the power to continue to have strong vaccination policies despite what's happening at the federal level? I mean, some things like the cancellation of the meeting that is required as part of choosing what goes into the next flu shot. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's not much that they could do at that level. But is there a backstop here, I guess, to where there are communities full of people who want to say, hey, I want a strong vaccine policy in place for myself, my family, my community?
You bet there is, Kim. I'm glad you're asking that because, hey, the feds control some things that the states can't change. The feds control what gets approved as a vaccine. FDA has to do that. California and others can't approve a vaccine that FDA didn't. They can't market it. They can't use it. The feds have control of vaccine allocations. They have a lot of resources. Vaccines for Children's Program through CDC is responsible for millions of kids getting vaccinated. You pull the plug on programs like that, and you don't distribute vaccines for free to Americans that cannot otherwise afford them, we've got some serious problems. But states are in control of a lot more than we sometimes give them credit for. It's state vaccine laws that we're adhering to, not federal for the large part. When the vaccines become available, states are the ones that set the terms for when and how they'll be utilized, when a mandate may be implemented versus simply a recommendation. And you know, a lot of vaccines are just recommended. If you're at particular risk for a condition, you're elderly, you probably should get that flu shot, but it's not mandated. But to be sure, the real risk we run here, Kim, is something we're also going to be watching for carefully. And that is, when the feds cross that line, when they cross that line of trying to dictate to states what their actual vaccine laws and policies should be, that's a line we're going to be watching really carefully. And you may wonder, well, how could that happen? Why would the feds intervene and try to control state law in this respect? Because if there's real concern expressed through HHS, CDC, or FDA about particular vaccines or how far we should be using them, or maybe the voters who put persons in place of that nature just do not want any more of these vaccine laws at the state level interfering with their liberty interests or how they perceive them. The federal government does have control of the, what we call the control of the purse, what's known as the spending power, as we know, to set conditions. And those conditions could be, for example, that if you want access to these hundreds of thousands of doses of free vaccines for children in your state through your Medicaid program or otherwise, you're going to adhere to some new terms. And those terms could be the types of things that erode vaccine laws and policies at a state or local level. That's very concerning and something to watch for, because very few states have the resources to pass up those federal bucks for vaccines or the free distribution of them. But could the terms of that distribution start to change? Well, there's every reason to believe the U.S. Supreme Court would let that happen. There's every reason to believe Secretary Kennedy may very well seek out that type of control.
So given that risk, what can Americans do? What would you say to our listeners right now in terms of what they should do to ensure that they themselves are safe and their families and communities are also safe too?
Great point. Listen, one of the things that's very critical, I think, for everybody to recognize that what's not on the table at this point, at least at this juncture, is denying Americans that want to get vaccinated the chance to do it. All right, so if you want to be vaccinated for flu or, heaven forbid, avian flu vaccines, if it comes to that, does that threat lingers, or any of the other conditions that are vaccinatable, we already have approved vaccines and very few people are challenging those, then you get that done. I mean, you get that done. We have existing provisions within the Affordable Care Act and other protections in place to make sure these are essential services. Your insurance will cover it. You are very likely going to have a chance to get vaccinated if you want to. So choose to do it. But for a lot of Americans, Kim, as we know, they can't afford any co-pays or any, you know, out-of-pocket expenses for vaccines. They're just trying to afford food on the table at this point, especially in this continued, you know, sort of speculative economy. So consequently, what you really need to do is be out front, forceful in regards to how essential vaccine access is in your local community, at your state level, and before the feds. Don't let states like Louisiana has done literally restrict the messaging or the access to vaccines, as that entire State Department of Health was instructed by its governor to do late last year, literally stopping vaccine campaigns and education and access in their tracks. That's unacceptable. That is a direct threat to your health, not just your community's health, yours. Don't accept it. And even if you find that your access to vaccines has been cut down or cut off, be crafty and sort of creative about it. Various different ways to seek out vaccine access, even in other jurisdictions that may be offering it. Listen, you just can't afford life without vaccines for the purposes of personal health and safety. It will be a life, unfortunately, that children and others across the United States do experience real morbidity and mortality in. That's not sustainable in the United States, but all of us are going to have to seek out the better life that vaccines offer.
Yeah, I often repeatedly say to people, let your elected officials know what you want them to do. And I know for it that sometimes sounds inconsequential. You know, call your congressperson, call your state rep, call members of your local and city councils. But it is important and it does work. We're even seeing that at a federal level here in Washington, that does work, so that it's important to have your voice heard. We the people are who make up the government, and it is we the people who must continue to have a voice with this. James, last question to you is, because information is so important, so I want you to talk a little bit about what folks in my industry, the news industry, can do to help keep people safe. I mean, I'm thinking of, for example, during the early days of COVID, I saw a lot of reports about, you know, fear of vaccine hesitancy in Black communities because Black people are skeptical of vaccines, and it's all because of the Tuskegee experiments and other horrific things that have happened in the past. And it turned out that just given some information and also seeing how folks like first responders and essential workers were far more at risk, and they tended to be Black and Brown Americans, we saw an uptake in vaccinations in Black communities that eventually surpassed that of other populations. You just explain to people what the stakes are, what the risks are, what the risks aren't, and they make good decisions. So how can public information, talk about the importance of public information, and what can folks in my industry do to help keep people safe?
Those are such great points. And I did love to see just how much, you know, literally within specific populations, Black and others during COVID, they eliminated their own health disparities they were experiencing by uptaking good information, making really good choices, and being protected against one of the great scourges that we'll probably ever see in regards to COVID-19. So I love seeing some of those results. It really boils down for me to a lot of fronts. First of all, health journalists like you, they're professionals and know their business and know what they're doing. The best reporting I'm seeing out there, they cover these issues well. The outbreaks in measles in Texas, it's responsible, affirmative, well-done reporting. It's clear, and it's making very much the case for the need for vaccines. And it's doing so against the backdrop of sheer facts. I love seeing that, and that's what I think great journalists can do, is communicate the actual facts of what health authorities are saying at the local, state, federal levels, what and how far these specific vaccines have gone for the purposes of protecting populations, and what not getting vaccinated has meant in West Texas and New Mexico and other places. Great stuff there. But you know what? Here's the problem. There's a countervailing information source out there. notwithstanding all of the control that media has over so much of what great information we get, irresponsible circulation of information through social media and other accounts has to be countered as well. And I actually think some of the better efforts you might see through journalists going forward is to recognize those trends are out there, that people are surfacing misinformation about vaccines, be it flu, avian flu, COVID, whatever be the case. Explain to people what those misinformation or those myths are, so at least when they see them show up on social media and what looks like legitimate channels, they'll understand that's the type of misinformation that we have to ignore or at least be responsive to by working to defeat as well. That coverage, that sort of critical observation, I think is still needing a little more effort out there to dispel some of those rumors and myths.
All right, James Hodge, thank you so much for joining me today. I've learned a lot. I already was a big pro-vaccine person. I'm going to make sure that I stay up to date on everything else, including trying to find a way to check out my own immune response to measles, given what's going on and the fact that I have family in Texas. So that's going to be important for me as well. And you've taught our audience a lot as well today. So thank you for joining me on Justice by Design.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you. And thank you for all your great efforts to this end.
You know, in having the conversation with James, I think about how simple this could be. Yes, there are a small number of people in our nation who, because of religious views or their own personal health situation, perhaps should make a choice not to vaccinate. But if you want to be a part of our society, and to have a sense of caring about your neighbor, caring about your nation, it seems so fundamentally clear that doing so means being smart about vaccinations. Yes, get information. Yes, talk to your doctor. Yes, do all the things that people who are prudent do. But to say that vaccination policy is somehow attacking you or taking something away from you is just such a terrible way to think about it. You know, I think about Snickers. I can't take her to doggy daycare. I couldn't even get her a dog license without proving that she had vaccinations to keep other dogs safe. We can do better for ourselves in terms of policy than we can do even for our beloved furry family members. And we must. Thank you for listening to Justice by Design. If you like this podcast, go to wherever you get your pods and give it a 5-star rating, because that helps other people find it. I'm so grateful at the growth that this podcast has seen, and I'm grateful for every single listeners. But I do want you to tell your friends, tell your family members, tell your mom what good information you're finding here from the people who are actually making justice happen in America, and bring them along. And I will see you next week with another episode of Justice by Design. Take care.